Welcome to Insights and Indicators. I'm Jason Thomas, Carlyle's Head of Global Research and Investment Strategy. In this podcast, I share observations and opinions on the economic landscape, as well as insights from research being conducted by our team here at Carlyle. This episode was recorded on January 7th, 2026, and the discussion reflects composite portfolio data and analysis of recent government reports that are accurate as of that date. Today, I'm here by myself to discuss our annual outlook piece, Five Questions for 2026. Why questions? Why do we do questions? Well, because they make explicit the assumptions that we think mere predictions often hide. They also examine the contingencies, as we'll see, for forecasts to come to fruition, which often positions investors to adapt better to new information as it comes in, adjust their forecasts accordingly. You know, for example, last year, rather than furnish estimates of what the impact of tariffs was likely to be entering 2025, we simply asked the question, what is the purpose of tariffs? We did that because the intention behind the policy was really the most important element of understanding what was to come. Over the course of the year, I think it became very obvious by May or June that the main purpose of tariffs was to raise revenue. Effectively, this was like a backdoor value-added tax that has since then collected over a percentage point of GDP in revenue, in about $300 billion annualized. And it's important when you have a source of revenue that you're expecting to come in, you actually have to worry about the tax base, which in this case is imports. So as a result, you have to set the effective tax rate so that you're attempting to maximize revenue. And I think the baseline tariff rate that we've seen, you know, in that 15, 16 percentage point range really does feel like a revenue maximizing tax rate. And so this actually ended up proving much less disruptive than many people feared. A 15 to 16% rate for many management teams, you know, it feels like a sudden, certainly unwelcome move in foreign exchange rates. So while, you know, at this time last year, a lot of people were preparing for something really exotic, quite dramatic. Obviously, we had Liberation Day, the initial schedule on April 2nd. Ultimately, it proved to be something that, again, was more familiar, something, again, like an FX shift that management teams had to deal with in the normal course of business. And so I think, again, we enter 2026 with an economy that has weathered that storm relatively well. So this year, we have a new set of questions for a new year, a new environment, new, I think, consensus outlook that, for the most part, looks very benign. So in the same vein, we'll just sort of interrogate some of the assumptions that are embedded in the current broad consensus market forecast. And our first question for 2026 is, how will the affordability crisis, quote unquote, influence Fed policy? So right now, entering 2026, we had rates markets, forwards, futures, that priced two more cuts this year. But I think more interesting than that is that options on futures imply that seven rate cuts are as likely as one rate hike. So this is really a very dramatic asymmetry. Essentially, markets are saying that, you know, maybe the Fed won't cut rates as much as we'd like. Maybe we end up at something like 3%, but we really don't have to worry at all about rate hikes. And that's sort of an interesting perspective in and of itself, given that the outlook for growth is fairly robust. And you see that with some of the cyclical stocks that have been performing very well at the start of the year, reflecting this broad consensus about growth being strong. But what's much more interesting is that these expectations coincide with a political environment in Washington that's become engulfed with these concerns about, again, this so-called affordability crisis. And it's interesting, a lot of people say, well, affordability crisis, what does that mean? You know, it seems exotic. It's not clear what the implications of that may be. But I think the explanation for the affordability crisis is actually very simple and straightforward. The Fed, over the last 5 years, has essentially presided over this sustained period of above target inflation, allowing the overall price level in the United States to increase by nearly 25%. So as a result of that, virtually everything is a lot more expensive than it was, and voters don't like it. So we're setting up for a situation where at the start of this Congress, the start of the year, the start of the session of this Congress, I should say, there's going to be lots of proposals to combat unaffordability across the entire spectrum of spending categories, including targeted public outlays, aggressive antitrust enforcement for pricing collusion. There's talk, of course, of tariff rebate checks. So I think, again, this is going to be where most of the action is on the policy front. But at the same time, each Fed meeting, all the commentary in advance of the Fed meetings is going to be about, are we going to get more rate cuts? Or is policy going to be looser? Is there going to be actions taken to certainly support labor markets, but potentially have more upward pressure on inflation, even as it continues to run a full percentage point above the Fed's 2% target? So this question, how will, again, the political dynamics of affordability crisis influence Fed policy? I think that investors need to be concerned that this affordability issues does not remain siloed in what Congress is doing or what the president proposes, but could ultimately spill over onto Fed operations. I mean, after all, the Fed is the government agency that is formally tasked with price stability. And so when people talk about independence, they talk about political interference, very often they mean that the Fed is going to cut rates more aggressively to bend to the will of political authorities. What's interesting is that we could have a situation where the political authorities, elected officials, actually demand that the Fed take a tougher line on these price increases that have so bothered their constituents and voters. And again, maybe not. I think the basic outlook is fairly reasonable, but I do think that there is this total lack of appreciation for this potential spillover of what is the central political issue in Washington today. The second question we ask in 2026 is, have critics focused on the wrong credit boom? And essentially what I mean by this is, again, generally very benign outlook for the economy and markets. But some people suggest that if something were to go wrong, it would likely be as a result of private credit. Of course, private credit AUM has grown fairly dramatically, over the last 7 or 8 years. And I think that this perspective is really very odd. Private credit, whatever its faults or whatever one's opinion of it, seems a really unusual candidate for trouble. And that's largely because private credit involves 3 to 5 times as much equity backing loans as if that same credit were extended by banks. And it also involves outstanding borrowing that has a maturity that typically matches or exceeds the maturity of the loans that leverage is used to fund. So this is what you think of as a very stable liability structure, very highly equitized, and no maturity mismatch in terms of the borrowing of a fund and the maturity of the assets that the fund holds. And when you think about crises or, when things have gone wrong, financial stability risks, market risks, almost always and everywhere, it's actually the liability structure that's paramount. It's essentially problems happen when you have short-term debt that is used to finance assets that have an either longer-term maturity or higher volatility. So it's that mismatch between the assets and liabilities that is generally the recipe for trouble. And the models and also just empirical evidence has really done a very good job of explaining the financial difficulties we've had over time. The basic model of, again, short-term borrowing to fund longer-term, more volatile assets explains 2007, 2008 crisis in repo markets, in commercial paper, wholesale funding markets. It certainly explains the 2023 collapse of Silicon Valley Bank. And again, can be extended to virtually any other circumstance. Where it does not apply, again, is private credit, because of the maturity matching on the borrowing and, again, the equitized capital structure. But what's interesting is that if you were to look at risks to financial stability, if you were to say that, I'm worried in 2026 that there could be a substantial market drawdown or volatility in bond markets, it's actually not really hard to find where some excessive short-term borrowing has occurred that could result in some volatility ahead. So since the fall of 2022, of course, when the stock market bottomed, the total value of margin credit extended by broker-dealers to purchase securities, mostly stocks, has increased by 87%. That's 22% annualized growth and has reached a record $1.2 trillion. Over the same period, hedge funds' prime brokerage balances have doubled, that's 26% annualized growth, to $3.2 trillion. That's mostly to finance stocks and then derivatives positions, while hedge funds' overnight repo borrowing has increased 2.7-fold to 39%. That's 39% annualized growth and reached a peak of $3.1 trillion. At the same time, of course, that there's been this significant increase in short-term leverage to fund positions in stocks and bonds, the U.S. government, the U.S. Treasury, has dramatically increased its short-term borrowing, which is up by 81% since 2022, with Treasury bills now financing $6.7 trillion, or about 22% of the $30 trillion in marketable U.S. Treasury securities outstanding. Now, you know, the short-term borrowing all entails somewhat different risks for the margin credit for prime brokerage borrowers. It's not really the banks that are at risk. The banks are well capitalized, seem to be quite adept at dynamically managing their liquidity, capital, and concentration risks. But if there is some increase in implied volatility, realized volatility, a drawdown in asset prices, there could be this very sharp reduction in available credit balances. So essentially, it's market falling by 5%, implied volatility rising, then requiring those borrowers to de-risk quite suddenly. And there's a potential for, again, a 5-6% decline in markets to actually turn into something much worse. I think what's interesting also is at the end of 2025, the Fed not only cut rates, but of course announced that they were going to launch $40 billion in monthly reserve management purchases. Part of that motivation, of course, is just the sense that bank reserves balances in the system had grown too low. And there were signs of excessive volatility in these short-term funding markets, particularly in repo, where rates had risen well above the Fed funds target. And what's interesting about the reserve management purchases is that they're really explicitly designed to suppress volatility in these overnight secured rates. And that is by stabilizing money markets, likely to free up more market liquidity to sustain the growth in repos, dealer balance sheets, and margin credit. So markets have interpreted RMPs as a very bullish signal, you know, just suggesting that the Fed is not worried about signs of potential speculative excess or too much short-term borrowing, but is actually willing to backstop those markets, essentially taking Treasury bills, $40 billion a month, off of the market. So again, so that liquidity can be freed up for other purposes. So again, I don't mean to alarm anyone about this. I think that the Fed intervention and the RMPs could, you know, durably stabilize markets. But again, if you're concerned about financial stability, if you're concerned about market fragility, I think this is absolutely the place to look. And again, the wondering if attention has been focused in the wrong direction. Our third question is, you know, sort of our effort to engage somewhat in what has been dubbed the AI bubble debate. We don't take that question on directly. We ask, will data centers crowd out investment in other sectors? And really the motivation for this question, towards the end of 2025, having a chance to talk to investors as they've received more fund updates and, you know, just reassessing their portfolio, it became clear that they had really taken most of their incremental risk budget over the last few years in real estate, in infrastructure, in stocks, and now increasingly in credit, was being consumed essentially by data centers, by AI thematics that had really come to dominate their portfolios. I think that's really most evident if you look at real estate. And by 2025, data center development in the US surpassed spending on all other commercial buildings combined. Since the introduction of ChatGPT in November of 2022, data center assets being put in place have grown over threefold, while all other real estate development is up by less than 10%. So what you've seen is this move from investors' portfolios, essentially the fund holdings, very decisively away from traditional class asset sectors like office, lodging, healthcare, residential, towards data centers. And the same trend is evident in infrastructure, really because of these mega deals, mega projects. The cost of greenfield data center projects has tripled, really just over the last year, to more than $3 billion. Of course, the infrastructure projects require quite a lot of energy that is consumed by these supercomputers. And the expectation is for an additional $1.4 trillion in electricity and other energy-related infrastructure spending to support the energy consumption of these data centers. So even in infrastructure, data centers have gone from less than a quarter of closed transaction volumes to roughly two-thirds of the entire market just over the last 4 or 5 years. So, you know, this gets us to 2026 and what to expect. And I think that in general, there's expectations of continued growth, spending intentions, really continuation of the current trends of assets being put in place. But the big change is that for the most part, hyperscalers in the past used their internally generated cash flow, their prodigious cash from operations, to invest in the acquisition of data centers. It was cash from operations that financed CapEx. In the last 4 months of 2025, they had to turn to credit markets. Their CapEx budgets are now outstripping the cash on hand. And they issued $100 billion in loans and bonds, again, to fund continued growth in data center capital spending. And so they accounted for 30% of investment grade issuance, and that's up threefold of their share from 2024. Again, I don't think anyone, given this cash generation from the core business, I don't think anyone's suggesting that these companies like Microsoft, Amazon, Alphabet, et cetera, can't handle higher debt loads. But it's just that all of a sudden, there's the same concerns about credit market investors and banks and others syndicating loans, where it's how much of their incremental risk exposure do they want to have tied up in data centers? And what does it mean for credit availability more broadly? So really the question here is, when you discuss the risks to the outlook for data center and broader AI CapEx, you often hear concerns about the inadequacy of available capital. And, you know, people have suggested the need for public support here, the long lead times for power generation capacity, you know, things that are ordered today not coming online until 2028. Certainly hear a lot about the shortage of skilled labor, particularly electricians. But I think the numbers here have just reached levels where it's time to start thinking about economy-wide resource constraints. And also, more importantly, I think investors' collective willingness to absorb incremental data center risk. And again, going back to the conversation with some investors, I think for capital allocators, it's one thing to position their portfolio on the right side of a looming technological divide. And I think they've done a great job of that, being forward thinking about AI and AI-related risks to incumbent businesses. But it's quite another when you allow your portfolio, all of your portfolio's risk budget or incremental stock, real estate, infrastructure, and credit exposures to become so highly correlated with a single risk factor. And so I'll conclude by saying that, you know, I think that in some ways the AI bubble debate is misleading, because it could be that it's actually fears of imprudent risk concentration, just again, having too much exposure to data centers, that could emerge as the binding constraint here, which doesn't require any skepticism about expected returns on data center development or AI more broadly. It's just a sense that it's imprudent to have this much correlated and concentrated risk. Question four deals with, I think, another risk that has been highlighted in some forecasts for 2026, and that is the rising bond yields, or just concerns about fiscal situations of advanced economies more generally. And the question is, what message or bond and FX markets sending about Japan? And Japan, I think, has been singled out here because of certainly it has a very high 230% of GDP gross debt ratio. But specifically what some analysts have pointed to is that with the Bank of Japan hiking rates to 75 basis points in 2025, with longer-term bond yields rising, the interest differentials that really explained a very weak yen have narrowed. But rather than respond to the narrowing interest differentials by rising significantly in foreign exchange value, the yen finished 2025 basically in the exact same place it started it. So the yen hasn't moved even as the interest differentials that presumably explained the weak yen have narrowed. And so critics suggest that the yen has not responded to rising yields because the stock of debt in Japan is so large that the Bank of Japan cannot take interest rates to levels necessary to reduce inflation, push it back down to their 2% target without effectively bankrupting the government, you know, taking the interest expense on that debt up to unsustainable levels. The argument here is very simple, and that is that Japan is really being unfairly targeted here. And in many ways, first of all, the Japanese public finance situation looks actually better than that of the United States and other advanced economies. So yes, Japan has a gross public debt that is enormous, but it doesn't really lend itself to cross-country comparisons because so much of that debt has been used to acquire financial assets. So after subtracting Japan's social security reserves and other official asset holdings, the IMF estimates that the net debt ratio in Japan is only 130% of GDP. But Fed research looked at the asset holdings of other government agencies or their affiliated investment vehicles. And when you account for those asset holdings, which again had been funded through this gross debt issuance, you end up with a net debt ratio that's actually closer to 80% of GDP, which is 20% lower than that of the United States. Also, when you think about the financing needs, how much does a government need to borrow each year? And you compare that to the total amount of savings that the private sector generates. That's savings of households, also the free cash flow of the corporate sector. Japan's annual financing needs account for just 6% of private savings. That's about one-fifth the burden in the United States and only about half that of the EU. So, you know, what explains the weak yen? Well, I think a lot of it has to do with this remarkable recovery in financial conditions and the broader economy that we've observed since Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was elected at the end of 2012. Essentially, the aggressive monetary easing that occurred after that, after Kuroda was appointed as governor of the BOJ, allowed, you know, buying Japanese government bonds in record quantities, buying other assets, it succeeded in reviving inflation expectations, driving bond yields down to levels where they're actually finally able to engineer the decline in real interest rates that was necessary to cure the yen's chronic overvaluation. Between 1992 and 2012, the Japanese economy actually contracted by nearly 1% in yen terms. That's a 20-year period with zero growth in nominal income. And during that period of time, the yen was about 40% overvalued on a purchasing power parity basis. And that uncompetitive exchange rate was a key driver of the depressed return on domestic capital. It, of course, encouraged Japanese corporates to move production abroad. And this ability to get real rates low to cure this chronic overvaluation, getting the yen to more competitive levels, is really a key ingredient in the recovery of Japan since then, boosting the profitability of domestic businesses by about 10 percentage points, leading to a sustained, sizable increase in domestic investment, and also facilitating a 40% drop in unemployment over that period of time. So this is a situation where the Bank of Japan doesn't look to be in a box. It's just, you know, worried about rocking the boat. And, you know, I think bond investors see that there's this sort of tentative stance with Bank of Japan, how aggressive they're going to be. And I think in response to this timidity, understandably want to shed duration risk. You know, they're not eager to hold 10, 20, 30, 40 year Japanese government bonds. It's something that we see in other economies as well, as a steepening yield curve, increase in the term premium. But in Japan, I think, again, it's very much related to the success that has been observed over the last 13 years. And just, you know, a sense that you don't want to undermine a key ingredient of that turnaround in broader economic and financial conditions, which, of course, has been a yen that's far more competitive. Finally, our fifth question, we ask, does the European Union need a new treaty? And this is really a question that is posed in response to, you could say, some of the sluggishness with regard to the competitiveness agenda that was unveiled a year ago, or now about 15 months ago. In September of 2024, former ECB President Draghi released what I think was 383 separate proposals for really overhauling the economy of Europe, recognizing the competition from the United States, change transatlantic relationship, looking at the competition from China, and thinking of ways to really boost the continent's competitiveness so that it could thrive in this new world. But as of the end of 2025, barely 10% of Draghi's agenda and then the broader European Commission's competitiveness agenda has been implemented. And you could say at the year end, the outlook for some really core elements of the plan, such as the savings and investment union, looks bleak. There doesn't seem to be the appetite to move much on some of these critical components of this plan to boost productivity, boost investment, accelerate growth. And I think a lot of people blame the lack of progress on insufficient political will, or some have said, well, there's no economic crisis to spur action. The EU really only achieves policy goals in the midst of crisis. But I think that, you know, there's actually an argument that Draghi's report and this broader competitiveness agenda actually envisions EU-wide coordination and decision-making on a scale that actually seems a bit beyond the EU's existing institutional framework. What I mean by that is the EU, of course, remains a supranational institution. It's governed by treaties. Those treaties defined the competencies that are held in Brussels, the authorities' competencies held in Brussels, and then those competencies that are retained by member states. It also, of course, specifies the institutions and processes that are responsible for that collective EU decision-making. And the treaties were agreed in an era where Brussels was really supposed to be focused on policing market-distorting state intervention, state aid by member states. Now, Brussels is being asked to coordinate state interventions into the economy in pursuit of a pan-EU industrial policy. Again, that industrial policy may be very necessary to compete with that of China and now the United States. But again, this is quite opposite from the intention of the EU and its authorities. Secondly, treaties afford member states very significant veto rights in areas like taxation, joint borrowing, defense, foreign policy, that compromise the EU's ability to act collectively to respond to security challenges. This has proven very challenging, and I think has hamstrung some of the efforts relative to a different arrangement, a different sharing of authorities. And even, you could say, the internal barriers to trade. The IMF points out that intra-EU tariffs, these frictions that exist in product and services markets, are tantamount to a 40% tariff on manufactured goods traded between EU member states and 110% tariff on services. So this would, you know, seems the most obvious place to start in terms of improving competitiveness, increasing intra-EU trade. But these frictions largely arise from the regulatory authorities, safety and others, that are explicitly retained by EU member states in treaties. So even, again, the most obvious place for reform is something that seems that it'd be difficult to actually implement in the absence of treaty reform. So, you know, a treaty, it used to be something that happened quite regularly. The Treaty of Rome, 1957, and then between that and the Treaty of Lisbon in 2007, there was a new EU treaty about every 7 or 8 years. Now, we're in the longest period of time since a prior treaty has been agreed. That was 2007. So now, you know, that was December of 2007 was the agreement. So now we're 18 years from the last treaty, the longest time in history. I think while the strongest case for a new treaty is economic, again, being able to implement the agenda to increase defense spending, to prepare for the new security situation that exists today, it really comes down to, I think, the fissures in the transatlantic relationship. It's the geopolitics, relations with the United States, changed environments that have really been the impetus for the major treaties of the past. You know, for example, that foundational treaty of Rome, 1957, it occurred the year after the Suez Crisis. No Suez Crisis, I'm not sure you get a Treaty of Rome. Similarly, the Political and Monetary Union of Maastricht, the treaty that essentially formed the European Union as we know it today, came in 1992. It was the culmination of a process set in motion by the collapse of the Soviet Union, the collapse of the communist bloc in Eastern Europe, and of course, German reunification. So it was adjusting through treaty the arrangement among EU member states in response to these new realities. And I think that today, given, again, the friction that exists between the United States and Europe, seems like a moment in time that actually lends itself to something similarly momentous, a, you know, deepening of integration across member states and a change in the way that the authorities are shared between Brussels and member state capitals. I think that, you know, there's a saying among investors that an economy with massive untapped potential should raise suspicion rather than excitement. Essentially, you know, what that means is you really need to find out why an economy has failed to live up to its potential, because that may be persistent in the future. And therefore, all of that underlying potential that you see is going to be squandered prospectively. And I think that with Europe, of course, the potential we see with the scale, the human capital, the savings that far in excess of the United States, technological capability, vast internal market. But there have been difficulties preventing Europe from capitalizing on all those enormous advantages it has. Thankfully, in this case, there's not some exotic or you know, hard to pin explanation. It is simply the inability to adjust, or the failure thus far to adjust institutions for the new reality. And I think that just as they've done that time-tested path of the last 60 years, it's time for a new treaty. And Europe should embrace the lessons from its own history in that regard and really formally recalibrate its institutions for this new world that I think everyone generally knows exists. And I do think that if that were to happen, or if there were signs in the direction of that happening, we'd very likely see a dramatic change in investors' perspectives towards Europe. And it could very well become the most attractive destination for capital over the next 5 to 7 years. So those are our questions. I hope you go to Carlyle.com to read the paper. Look forward to any feedback you may have. And as always, thanks for listening. And I hope you'll join us for next month's episode of Insights and Indicators.